This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 45 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me, as he always is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be joined by our fellow Trek FM host, Aaron Harvey, Trek FM's art director and host of Saturday Morning Trek, Trek FM show on Star Trek in the 1970s. We are going to be talking about our top picks for essential Trek philosophy from Star Trek, the animated series. Mike, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Zachary. I'm feeling a little bit animated today. So, you know, if I seem a little out of character, that's my shtick.
Well, as long as you're dressed appropriately, did you wear your pink animated pants?
Yes, today? And unlike Mr. Scott, I do have pants on. So, yes, I did. I'm really excited to have Aaron Harvey, Trek FM's uber-talented art director and host of Saturday Morning Trek. I can't imagine doing this essential Trek philosophy animated series without him. And Zachary, I just received a hail from the Bonaventure, and it seems that Aaron is ready to beam over. So let me get with the transporter chief. Transporter chief, engage. Aaron, welcome. Welcome to the Starship Theseus. We're so glad to have you join us today.
Everything looks less colorful here. It's kind of interesting.
We need to get a better art director in here to spruce up the place. that's one of the reasons why you're here. We need some advice.
But your Starship Delta looks very centered and symmetrical on your shirt. That's kind of a nice change.
Well, you know, if we were doing the animated series, the Saturday Morning Trek, we'd probably, it would be a little bit larger, a little bit off center, but you know, we got regulations around here and got to follow them.
I got a kick out of that when I was rewatching the animated series. I've never really noticed how off centered they really, I mean, there's like a full 90 yeah. degrees at some point.
Backward hands, missing pants.
Three hands sometimes.
Yes, color changing faces. And we're not, and three, when you're talking three hands, we're not talking about Eric's.
No,
either.
No, I'm talking about Kirk.
Yes.
Actually, technically, it wasn't three hands. It was just that one of his pant legs was colored skin colored.
Interesting.
So it appeared to have three arms, but there are three hands, but yeah.
Well, we were talking in the turbo lift, Aaron. You and I are relatively the same age, and this is the Trek that you and I grew up on, playing with Mego figures and watching the animated series and reruns of the original series on television in the early 1970s.
Yeah, I had the Mego figures. The neighbors had the bridge set, which we were talking about. It was basically a cardboard box with sort of a plastic mural wrapped around it, depending on what playset you had. They would do the same thing for the $6 Million Man and the Bionic Woman and all of those. And then they would have some sort of plastic attachment. The bridge set had the sort of spinning kind of cylinder sort of thing that made it appear as if the person had beamed off the ship by just turning him around and hiding him. I Star Trek, the animated series, was a big part of my childhood. It was the first live new Star Trek that I saw. And it, like I said, it ran constantly through the 70s, even though it was only on for two seasons, which the second season was sort of a short one.
Yeah. I think five episodes.
Six.
Six. Yep. Yeah.
See, and I think I come from the exact opposite end of the spectrum, where I was born in 1978, so I'm a few years younger than you guys. And so Star Trek the Animated Series was not on my radar at all growing up. I grew up on like Voltron and Transformers and the 1980s cartoons. I don't think I even, frankly, knew there was an animated series probably until my 20s.
Well, you were even in the era where people said that it didn't exist, and there was virtually no way to prove that it did. Because it wasn't on videotape yet. It wasn't, you know, you'd have to go to a library and find some sort of book on animation or something just to show that it was there. Or an old TV guide.
No Netflix, no YouTube. Nope. Yeah. So, you know, recently I started rewatching the animated series, and I have a small confession to make. You know, with everything on my plate going on right now, there's no chance I was going to watch the entire animated series to prepare for today. So that's my small confession.
You didn't have 25 minutes to spare?
You almost could watch the whole series in 25
minutes. We figured out like absolutely 9 hours or something like that.
But I don't get into animation lately much. Frankly, I just have so much in my mind. It's not on my radar right now. But I was really surprised how much I started to enjoy the animated series. There's this gestalt shift I had to make to really get in the mindset, to get in the 1970s-ness of it all, for lack of a better word. And I started to really enjoy it. So I'm looking forward to diving in and talking about our picks for Essential Trek Philosophy. And I was also surprised how much philosophy I could find in the animated series, given that it's essentially a children's show from the 1970s.
Yeah, I don't think you would find the same philosophical arguments or moral dilemmas that you would like in you would find in like Scooby-Doo or I Dream of Jeannie or My Favorite Martian or basically any live-action show that they somehow translated and threw onto television or onto cartoons. But they one of the reasons it didn't do spectacularly in their current and their rating system at the time was because it was only checking to see if children liked it. It was really popular mm-hmm. with adults, and if it was a cartoon that was made today, it would be like the animated Star Wars or something like that, where both kids and adults would have watched it mm-hmm. and then it would have probably lasted longer.
Yeah, I know when I first reached out to you about having you join us for this episode of Metatracks, I know you were kind of kidding back to me, and you said, "Hey, Mike, you know this is an animated series for children. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of philosophy in there, but in fact, I think it's rather rich considering that it was a children's cartoon, a Saturday morning thing. As far as the production value, yeah, Filmation." It's not that great as far as the aesthetic looks of it. And we were joking about, you know, Kirk and his three hands and, you know, the uniforms. And there were a lot of things wrong with the animation as far as the production value of it. And
the speed at which they cranked them out, too.
Yeah.
I think it was kind of amazing that they did get put together as fast as, you know, they basically, I think, had 3 months. And of that 3 months, 3 weeks was animation or something to that effect. It was not a lot of time. There was a lot of writing, mm-hmm. Writing time back and forth between Gene and Dorothy and, you know, the studio. So
that said, I'm actually really impressed with the way they captured the gestalt of the original series, just being aboard the Enterprise. It really feels yeah. like an episode, you know, like an episode of the original series. You know, the sounds and the blinking lights. It feels like you're in Star
yeah.
Trek.
And also, I think the fact that they were able to get the original actors to come and voice the characters, I think certainly lends to it. And I'm just really impressed at the way they were able to take a 23, 24-minute program and tell a halfway decent story that does have an interestingly complex moral play or, you know, a philosophical point that, you know, that they're trying to make. Whatever the purpose is of the episode, I'm really surprised. Don't get me wrong, some of them are very light on content, but I'm really amazed at how much they were able to pack into them. And even now, you know, here I am in my mid-40s, you know, finding little tidbits of really interesting philosophical content.
I think it's interesting that the 24-minute, you know, time frame, I think, caused them to focus some of their storytelling too, because there's, given a whole hour, it, you know, sometimes you get that extraneous stuff that just was, you know, not necessarily necessary to the plot and might have just drug it down actually. So
here, Zachary and Aaron, here's how Trek Essential Philosophy works here on Metatracks.
Okay.
What we've done, we've each selected three. I actually came with five, Aaron. I know you brought five, but we've pared them down to three essentials based on their philosophical content. We haven't shared our list, so I don't know what your lists are. You don't know what mine is. And we're just going to kind of go roundtable style. We're going to share one of our top three, and then we'll move on to, we'll go in the order of Aaron, Zachary, and then myself. And we'll each share an episode, explain, you know, what we found interesting about it. We'll discuss it. It might pop up on somebody else's list, and that's great. But I think this will be an interesting discussion, and it'll give us a chance to, I think, really make a case. I hope at the end of the day we've made a case that the animated series really does have some content that's worth diving into and paying attention to.
And we should say, for our listeners who haven't listened to one of these Essential Trek Philosophy episodes of Metatrex before, that the goal for the discussion in Essential Trek Philosophy is not to have an in-depth discussion about every nuance of a particular episode. Many times in Metatrex, we try to do a deep dive into the philosophical issues. Here, when we're trying to hit on the philosophical highlights, you know, if you wanted to pick up the animated series and watch three or four or five or nine episodes to, you know, get the Essential Trek Philosophy from that, what are the places we would steer you to. So we're going to touch on the important topics, have some really quick discussion, but we're not going to have the deep dive that we do on most of our episodes of Metatrex.
Indeed. But again, I think we want to make the case that for those folks out there who say the animated series is not Star Trek, and I know, Aaron, that's going to get you jazzed up. It does me. I think we can make a pretty good case that there's plenty of Star Trek here in the animated series.
And the whole idea of it's canon, it's not canon, actually came down to a legal issue, which had nothing to do with whether they believed that the stories were actually part of the universe or not. It was just when TNG started, there was a whole who owns what sort of thing, and it turned out for a short period of time that one part didn't own TAS, so that's... basically.
Yeah, if you start talking about animated series not being canon, you're going to get Aaron's Vulcan blood boiling.
Well, if you go look at, like, every show after it, it has, you know, references to things like that. So it's, like, especially Enterprise actually was quite a, you know, had quite a few callbacks to the animated series.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
And Star Trek 2009 kind of borrowed whole cloth, a whole chunk of that, and put it into the opening of the movie, Spock's Childhood.
Well, and as I've watched through the animated series again, I'm really surprised at the number of animated series shows that are remarkably familiar to Next Generation, even Voyager. I've picked up on some threads that were common in Voyager by watching the animated series.
Yes, actually, on our show, we're going to have Tristan on to talk about one of those episodes.
So. Okay. Should be interesting. I can't wait to hear that one. So, Aaron, you want to go ahead and share your first pick and talk a little bit about it?
Sure. My first pick is One of Our Planets is Missing, which is basically they get a notification from a planet that has like 82 million people and is also kind of governed by Robert Wesley from The Ultimate Computer. And he's retired and he's going to go, you know, live a quiet life here on this planet, and there is a giant basically 1,000-kilometer wide cosmic cloud coming towards the planet of 82 million people, and it's already eaten up another planet in the solar system, and that's how they get the One of Our Planets is Missing, though we see it destroyed right in front of you or in front of them, so it's not so much missing as it's one of our planets has now just been eaten. So they are basically left with this moral conundrum of, do they, one, destroy the cloud, which they have learned is a creature, how smart it is, they don't really know, they do know it's alive, or the other conundrum they have is, do they warn the people, these 82 million people on this planet, there's no way to get them all off, you know, do they tell them this giant thing is going to come and basically eat the planet and kill them? And, you know, it's sort of that, do you tell somebody they have cancer because there's nothing you can do about it or not? And it's just, I always thought that was really interesting. They play up pretty nicely, like, this dilemma in for a cartoon that, you know, for children, that the only people they're going to say be able to save are the children. So I guess that's something nice to hear if you're a kid. And
especially on Saturday morning.
Yeah. I mean, they basically wrestle with it, and they do finally, you know, hey, these people deserve to know that they're going to meet their end. But that is kind of an interesting, I always thought that was, you know, what do you do in that case? Like, would we want to know if an asteroid was going to destroy the planet?
Mm.
Yeah, this is something I haven't thought a lot about. I mean, what do you do in these kinds of situations where they're hopeless situations? You literally don't have the ability to make an impact. Do you beat your head against the wall and try to make an impact and save as many people as you can? Do you rush into the burning building or rush into the city on fire? Or do you just stand back and realize, you know, be not fatalist, but, you know, just accept the fate of things, that you just can't make an impact? And what do you do? It's an interesting dilemma. I mean, my gut reaction says, you know, it's there's something virtuous about trying your best, even in a futile situation. But
yeah. Well, and I think that is sort of the decision they did make, that, you know we can get the children off of the planet. So they were, you know, shuttling them. I guess they have enough ships. They must have had them in orbit. And I think it was, I want to say like 15,000. I can't remember. I think they said the name, but it, or the number. But it seemed like for the amount of people that were on the planet, it seemed like a small amount of children. So it was, you know, and then you have the alternate dilemma is, you know, Spock is trying to communicate with this creature, and yes, they could destroy it. They did figure out a way to do that, but it's also alive too, you know, so, and it kind of comes down to that the needs of the many outweigh mm-hmm. the needs of the few, but you got one that's gigantic, and it's like, it was, for a children's cartoon, I thought it was really interesting that they had so many, you know, packed into this one episode, all these different choices that these people had to make.
I think that's not something you see in a lot of, I mean, frankly, especially from that time period, animated cartoons. You don't see characters having to make hard moral choices, especially when the consequences are so bad. You know, when, you know, yeah. It's something like the trolley problem. Do you kill one people or do you kill five yeah, yeah. people? Right. You just no outcome is a good outcome. And those that's not usual Saturday morning subject.
You know, we get that in animated shows now, but animated shows aren't on Saturday morning and they aren't made just for children. They're basically a kind of a popular just form of entertainment that, you know, yes, kids watch them, but and I think we've heard the uproar from parents sort of die down. That used to be, it's like, why is this cartoon? Why does this have adult, you know, content and stuff? And now it's just, I think because those parents have gotten older and the kids that were the ones watching those are now parents, and they're just like, oh, cartoons, like comic books. Comic books used to be exclusively for children, and even though they would have stories in them that, you know, adults would like, now it really seems to have kind of flipped where it's like they're mostly for adults, and every once in a while I get a comic for kids.
So, Aaron, before we move on to talk about our next picks, let me ask you another question about that dilemma. Mm-hmm. Is there anything unique about the way that dilemma or that subject matter was approached in the animated series as opposed to a similar story that you might encounter in any of the live-action Star Trek series?
It has a lot of elements of the original series episode with the giant space amoeba.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it was a creature that you could reason with, but not necessarily, I don't think. I mean, Spock basically mind melds with this giant thing, and it's kind of cool because he gets this experience, not unlike V'ger, where he, from the motion picture, by the way, where he sensed everything that creature had seen, and it's this giant space-born creature, so he's experienced what it's experienced in space. So if I feel like he got a better understanding of the universe afterwards, but I think the way they answered or solved the question was a precursor to TNG, where it's basically we talk to them. Kirk would have blown it up. The animated series, because it was, you know, on Saturday morning, it did have to take a more conversational tract. So I think for the time it was unique. But overall Trek, it sort of almost felt like it set the tone for those sort of future encounters.
Yeah, I love the scene where Spock is communicating with it, you know, Census, we're inside you. For me, that was a game changer, and it felt a lot like, the creature itself felt a lot like the crystalline entity from TNG, where it, it was so foreign, so alien, that they just assumed that it was an it, when in fact, you know, when Spock says, you know, I've got this theory, I think the cloud's a living thing, it's alive, you know, for me, that just changes the stakes altogether.
That's an interesting dovetail into one of my picks for essential Trek philosophy. One of my picks is the Infinite Vulcan, and that's the episode with the plant-like aliens, for lack of a better word.
Written by Walter Koenig.
Yeah, exactly. Written by Walter Koenig, who you've interviewed. In fact, Aaron, that's an excellent chance to plug your own show, so to speak. On Saturday Morning Trek, you did an interview with Walter Koenig. Which episode of Saturday Morning Trek was that?
That was episode number two, actually. So, yeah, we got him on to discuss writing for the animated series. Spoiler, not the best experience that he had, because, and if you've listened to any of the books or any of read any stories from the 50th anniversary, you know that Gene was not the most fun person to work with as far as like editing goes. So, but that was episode two, and we talked to him about that and some of the other things that he wrote. It basically started his writing career.
Yeah, if you're listening to this and you haven't heard Aaron's interview with Walter Koenig, make sure you check out Saturday Morning Trek episode number two. It's must-listen Trek FM content, folks. So anyways, Infinite Vulcan, that was one of my picks. And the reason I put that on my list is that the animated series frees you up from a storytelling standpoint to include non-humanoid aliens. And we see a host of these inside the animated series. You mentioned something about 40% of the aliens are non-humanoid aliens in the animated series. And we do see that in other Star Trek series from time to time. The Crystalline Entity is a perfect example. But for me, philosophically, the issue that this raises is kind of a technical nuance or a technical term in philosophy of mind. The term that came to mind when I think about this is called multiple realizability. It's the issue or the question of whether the same mental states, whether it's emotions or intentions, feelings, whatnot, whether those can be instantiated by different kinds of physical substances. You know, our brains have a certain structure. They instantiate certain kinds of properties. It's a very interesting question whether those same properties can be instantiated by a radically different type of being with a radically different type of brain. Something more, even more radical would be something like this, the Crystalline Entity, you know, something with a totally different physical structure altogether. And I think the issue, this issue gets raised left and right inside the animated series. You know, the second you invoke a non-humanoid alien, you immediately raise the question, what is it like to be that kind of alien? What kinds of mental states? What kinds of properties does it have? Can we relate to it? Can we communicate with it? Do they have the same kinds of feelings and emotions and thoughts and intentions we do? Or do they have their own species variety of those that we just can't relate to in some way? So this issue of multiple realizability, I think it's going to come up anytime you get a non-humanoid species in Star Trek, but it comes up a lot in the animated series. And the episode that made that issue come to mind for me are the plant-like beings in the
Thalosians.
Thalosians, thank you. Eric.
Yeah, there's also another episode in season two which plays to that, but I won't mention it until somebody mentions it, and then I'll come back.
Well, Zachary and Aaron, I chose for my first pick actually the very first episode of the animated series, Beyond the Farthest Star. I really like what they refer to as a symbiosis between this magnetic organism, this malevolent energy source, and the computer. I don't think it was really a symbiosis at all. I think it was very much similar to the way Dr. Ira Graves in Schizoid Man was able to transfer his consciousness into Data and then later on into the computer. So I find that very interesting. And I know, Zachary, that, you know, we're kind of delving into the idea of spooky dualism. You know, what was the nature of this creature before? Is this its consciousness now non-corporeal or non-connected? And the way it's able to put itself into a computer, the whole creepy way it kept saying, obey. I found that rather comical, but you know, there was something very, very creepy about this entity that was able to take over control of the Enterprise and really hold Kirk and his crew captive.
That was on my list as well.
Okay. Yeah. Nature of consciousness, this creature that is able to transfer its consciousness from one place to another and, you know, control technology. I found that very fascinating.
Well, this is something that I'm genuinely confused about Star Trek in general and about this case in particular. Star Trek generally has what I would describe as a scientistic approach. You know, when the question of knowledge comes up, it's how can we study it? Let's, you know, bust out with the science the science, and learn what we can about it, right? But for some reason, Star Trek is obsessed with this consciousness transfer concept. So, you know, in all of these cases, when someone transfers their consciousness, you know, from their body into some other body or into a computer or whatever, you know, their brain gets left behind. And generally, most people accept some sort of physicalism that the brain is what gives rise to your consciousness in some mm-hmm. way, as an emergent property, an epiphenomenal property, something like that. But, you know, from episode to episode to episode, you know, where these transfers of consciousness happen, it's not a physical transfer. It's some sort of it's a katra, or it's a consciousness, or it's a disembodied whatever. It seems very loosely tied to the physical world that Star Trek generally tries to stay tied to.
Indeed. Indeed.
Well, and this creature wasn't necessarily, it didn't start with a brain. I mean, it was, I don't know where it started, but it was an electromagnetic.
Yes.
Basically, it was like a life form that coalesced out of, you know, electromagnetic patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I love the way in which you can tell these kinds of stories in Star Trek. You just, you know, in almost no other franchise can you tell these kinds of stories. You know, a life form that is not even a physical life form. It's electromagnetic, whatever. It's energy. Yep. It's, you know, fill in the blank. But you know, how in almost any other type of fiction, you just don't get to tell that kind of story. And it raises these questions: well, what exactly is consciousness, and how is it related to the physical world? And are these radically different kinds of consciousness? I think, you know, with other humanoid aliens in Star Trek, it makes sense to me that they're conscious and they have intentions and thoughts like we do. Even with my pets, for example, you know, they're close enough, right? they're biological, they've got brains. But, you know, if there are these other kinds of life forms that are so radically different, it forces you to broaden your sphere of what could count as consciousness. And it raises the question, how would we even recognize it if we saw it? What are we looking for if we go out into the universe searching for life? And can we communicate with it? And then it forces us to ask the question, what's essential about our own consciousness? You know, I think we tend to look at consciousness through our own human lenses. And I like that. I just love that stories like this broaden your horizons in terms of what could count as consciousness and what might be out there. And, you know, we don't have any direct experience of it. You know, we've never seen aliens like this, but, you know, conceptually, insofar as philosophers like to do thought experiments, if you can imagine a being that's not physical, that is conscious, if that's a conceptually coherent idea that doesn't seem to violate any logical laws of consistency, mm-hmm. maybe there are aliens like that. It might violate some physical law of nature, you know, that we don't know about, or maybe we do know about. But it at least passes the criterion of logical consistency. I could imagine a being like that, and I can imagine it has conscious intentions, and how it might work from a physics or biology standpoint, I have no idea, but it seems to at least pass the criterion of logical consistency.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the only thing that I really had a problem with in this entire episode, and again, just giving it, I think, the legitimacy that I think it deserves, I found the whole thing very fascinating, except the reference to the fact that, at least in Spock's mind, that there was some kind of symbiosis going on between the magnetic organism, they referred to it as, and the computer. It seems to me that the computer wasn't complicit in any type of relationship, as at least at this point in time, it's the computer's not sentient. So I don't really see a symbiosis there. More like, you know, this entity using technology basically for its own gain or own advantage.
And what I was going to speak about was not so much with the morality of the alien, but just the morality, what the light that it shed on the morality of the humans when they basically stranded it and took off as it's wailing. I mean, really kind of pitifully and sad and scary. I mean, yes, we don't know what happened millions of years ago when it clashed with that pod ship. But it was stuck there for that long. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe it was just, you know, it could have been a quote unquote good guy at the time.
Socially awkward.
Yeah. I mean, well, I mean, but, you know, there, who knows why it, you know, we have just the recording of that, the alien to say that was the only information we have about an outside view of that mm-hmm. entity. But, you know, putting that aside, it's like if you've been stranded for millions of years, I imagine you'd be a little crazy. I mean, it was just like, it would probably not be, you know, a great situation. We don't know if that if that was sort of their, they only lived by themselves, or if they had more, you know, other electromagnetic, you know, it sort of reminds me a little bit of the creatures on Enterprise. There was an episode where they took over the bodies of Trip and T'Pol. Mm-hmm. And
Observer effect, yeah.
Yes. But it was just, I don't know. I just felt that had they had more time, or if they had thought about it a little bit, they would have done something like, you know, we need, or they could have even had a throwaway line of, we need to send someone here to help rehabilitate this mm-hmm. creature, or study or learn more about it or something. It was just sort of like, bye-bye. It was like, we just dropped you off on this plane. You know, it tricked it into getting off the ship by almost crashing it, which is a little bit of a Janeway move there, I think.
she learned it from Kirk. She admired yes. She admires Kirk, you know.
That's true.
It does raise an interesting question. The thing that came to mind while you were talking was like Good Samaritan laws. You know, mm-hmm. what's our responsibility when people need help? Do we have an actual obligation in that situation, or are we perfectly fine in saying no, we're not going to get involved, and or we're gonna, in this case, we're gonna leave the alien where it is. We're not gonna be proactive. You know, is there a moral? Certainly, it's praiseworthy to help, right? But is it an obligation in those kinds of situations? I think it's a fascinating.
He didn't say he was going to take over things, and he needed the ship to get to. Well, it's been interesting. They're at the edge of the galactic barrier. Somehow, the ship has gotten to the. It's also written by mm-hmm. Sam Peoples, who wrote the Where No Man Has Gone Before. Is that it? The very first filmed episode with Gary Mitchell and mm-hmm. or not right, the very right. first film, but the very first Kirk episode. So you have that sort of the galactic barrier has all sorts of weird psychic creatures and stuff like that. So basically just don't go there. So, you know, it had some of the similar ideas. So I think it's kind of interesting. You know, he did basically, you know, put himself out as a bad guy, but it also feels like the way they left him was not ideal.
Your take on that's really interesting. I watched this just a couple of weeks ago with my daughter, Hannah. And at the end of the episode, she looked over at me and she said, that's really sad, you know, that you think they would try to help that thing. And so it's interesting that you're saying that, because I think a really legitimate observation. It does seem strange that there wasn't some type of attempt rather than just marooning this entity on a planet. And, you know, as they jump the warp, you hear that pitiful, help me, that pitiful moaning, you know, please, please come back.
And it's interesting, if they didn't do that, if those lines weren't there, I would have probably a completely different thought. You know, I wouldn't maybe not even think twice. Like, oh, okay, well, it was a bad guy.
But this is powerful. I wasn't there for this because I wasn't a kid when I watched this. But I can imagine if I was. I can imagine a kid watching something like this being having their emotions stirred, like being sad at the end of that. And that's good because, you know, I think... sometimes in this day and age, we want to kind of shield kids from negative or bad emotions. And there's nothing more powerful than just having a bad emotion pulled. Like if you make someone sad, that can force them to reflect, well, what is actually right and wrong? What should they have done? And it's not so intellectual at that age, I think, you know, definitely not for children, right. But by pulling that sad emotion at such a young age, that can make a powerful impact on people.
Well, I know I remember a lot of the animated series from yesteryear, so I'm sure someone will get to that.
And you don't go around stranding aliens on planets, right? So it made an impact.
Yes, exactly.
So, Aaron, what's next on your list?
Next on my list was that episode, but since we've talked about that, I will pull out something from my backup. Let's see. I would say probably a season 2 episode, Pirates of Orion, or Orion, as they pronounced it in this episode for some unknown reason, where we have kind of an interesting story of Spock has developed a blood disease. I can't remember how he got it now. That's horrible. But basically, it sort of robs his blood of oxygen or whatever component that the copper-based Vulcan blood needs. Mm-hmm. And there's only a few planets in the solar, or in the galaxy, that has the antidote. Why they aren't more everywhere, I don't know. Seems that there are enough Vulcans that they need to get this on a lot more ships. And so basically they have a ship bringing the cure to the Enterprise, because they won't actually make it to the starbase where it is if they just go there themselves. So they're meeting them halfway. And some Orion pirates basically steal the antidote. And so Kirk is sort of left having to bargain with the captain of the Orion. I keep saying it. It's like bounces back and forth. It is Orion, but they say Orion. A captain of his ship to get the drugs, and basically says, you know, we know that you're breaking the Babel Accords, but if you give us this medicine, we won't say anything. And I thought it was kind of interesting, because this really feels, especially because Spock's involved, it is the needs of the one outweighs the needs of the many, because they're going to do this again to somebody else. They're going to cause possibly more people to die. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't know what they're going to do in the future. It's like they really should be reported to the Federation, and they should lose their whatever their favored status. I can't remember exactly how they phrase it. I don't think they're part of the Federation, but they had some sort of a pact with them. And it's kind of interesting, because there's a lot of dense Star Trek mythology where they talk about Babel Accords and like very specific things, where if you're a kid, you're like, it's like watching C-SPAN. But it, you know, and they ended up basically trading immunity from prosecution, which wasn't theirs to give, for this antidote. And it turns out that when Orion missions go wrong, they have to commit suicide. So there's many levels of things in there you could talk about. But I thought it was kind of interesting that, yet we know that Kirk does things for his crew that he wouldn't normally do, but it just, you know, maybe he would have actually reported them after he got the medicine. I don't know. But it seemed that that was something pretty dense for a 70s cartoon TV show on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. You know, mm-hmm. It's just like, so I don't know if children could actually wrap their head around it. What's interesting is this was written by the youngest writer of a Star Trek episode ever. He was 19. So he sent the script in, and when they aired, he got everybody in his college together, and they watched it in a big room. He said it was like a mini convention, so that was kind of cool.
Yeah, and I wonder if Simon Pegg was inspired. There's a scene in this episode where Dr. McCoy is about to give Spock an injection, and he tells him,
yes,
it's not going to hurt a bit, Spock. And Spock says, an unnecessary assurance, doctor, in addition to being untrue. I wonder if Simon...
It was very similar.
Yes, very, very similar. And of course, McCoy gets aggravated at Spock, and he says, it's the last time I waste my bedside manner on a Vulcan. And Spock says, such restraint would be welcome.
There were great Spock and McCoy lines in this. This is the one where I really felt like they captured the original series really well. And I think it's kind of interesting, given that it was a fan that wrote it.
Yeah.
That it really had that, you know. Apparently it was also one of the few scripts, I think, that Gene said that he had to do the least with.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, what I think I love about the dilemma in this episode is that it seems a bit more sophisticated than dilemmas you get in other episodes. And a lot of times in Star Trek, even if they're good moral dilemmas, they're fairly simplistic moral dilemmas. You've got, you know, do you save 1,000 people or let the one person die kind of dilemmas. This is a case of conflicting loyalties. You know, you've got responsibility to the law, you've got legal responsibilities, you've got moral responsibilities to, you know, not trade with the Orions and do all these bad things. You've got loyalty to your friend Spock. You've got your responsibility as ship's captain. This is just a case of very conflicting, overlapping loyalties where the Captain Kirk is pulled in multiple directions. And a lot of moral dilemmas are like that. You know, you have conflicting responsibilities. And I think the deeper point is sometimes our values aren't consistent. They don't add up. They, you know, we do have loyalties to this group or loyalties to that organization, loyalties to this moral situation, and they, if we put them together and look at them, you know, in toto, they just don't add up. And that means that forces you as an individual to make hard choices, which loyalty, which responsibility is going to be the most important for you in this situation. And you don't get to rely passively on the law or passively on moral codes or rules and regulations. It's up to the actor to decide, actor in the sense of an agent, the actor as a moral agent to just say, what am I going to do? Which of these values is most important to me right now in this situation? And I like that this dilemma forces the first person choice aspect of a moral dilemma.
So Zachary, what's next on your list?
Okay, so next on my list is The Survivor. And that is the episode where Carter Winston gets duplicated / I don't know.
Ted Baxter.
Impersonated. by a shape-shifting alien who's not Odo. It's something else, right? Whatever it is, Aaron, you're good at remembering the aliens.
Vendorian.
Space squid.
Thank you, Vendorian. I'm so bad at, you know, it's partly because I just didn't grow up watching it. I have no ability to remember the details of what goes on inside the animated series. I feel terrible.
Apparently, but, people who worked on the animated series don't have an ability to remember the details of the animated series. So don't worry.
Okay, I'm not alone. I'm in good company then. But what I like about this episode, it's actually kind of related to my last pick about multiple realizability. What I like about this episode is it raises the question of, well, if these aliens are able to recreate an exact physical duplicate of Carter Winston, why isn't it just Carter Winston? If you kind of have in mind this principle that your consciousness or your mental states emerge out of whatever physically is going on in your body or in your brain, whatnot, in what sense is this recreation of Carter Winston actually not Carter Winston? If it has the same physical structure, the same memories, everything physically you could line up. In fact, the alien says as much inside the episode. I can create an exact physical duplicate of whatever I choose, something with the same mass and whatnot, but I don't have the same experiences. So what is going on there? If it's an exact physical duplicate, it seems like, you know, all the physical, chemical storage of memories in the brain would be duplicated as well. So isn't it just Carter Winston? And why is it a different being? And any kind of like all the episodes of Star Trek with transporter accidents, like where William Riker is duplicated, raises the same exact issues. Yeah. It's not a new issue, but I like that the animated series is dealing with it in a unique way.
Well, his fiance seems to think that he might as well be Carter Winston. I mean, she her. Anyway, ineffectual security officer. We had a very interesting conversation about this episode, though I do not remember the issue number, but it was one of the Women at Warp co-hosts was on with me, so it was Andy and I, so that was fun. But the question is like, is your physical body basically sort of a radio for your soul, where you tune it in and you get the right frequency and it's there, or whatever makes you. You know, because he seems like the longer he stays Carter Winston, the more like it he becomes, because he did, you know, go against the Romulan, basically the people who are using him as a spy.
Yeah, and he kind of says so to that effect. I mean, he basically says, you know, I guess I've become more Carter Winston.
Well, as I see it, there's sort of three options in this episode, three ways of reading the situation. One reading is that it just is Carter Winston. It's an exact physical duplicate, and for all intents and purposes, it's Carter Winston when it's in that form with those mental property, with the brain structure and all the physical stuff. Another option is that, well, it's not like that at all, that there's something above and beyond the physical that defines someone's consciousness, something dualistic, more spiritual. It doesn't have to be spooky metaphysics, but something above and beyond the pure physical manifestation that defines consciousness. And the third option would be, well, maybe it's just not an exact physical duplicate, that maybe that's just a vast oversimplification of what's going on inside the episode. Even though the alien says, I'm an exact physical duplicate, maybe that's just false and the whole issue dissolves if that's the case.
I think that one logic test you could have, that it can't be an exact duplicate, because he turns into a table. The table isn't going to have agency to turn back into something
else.
Well,
okay, he did that to try to get Nurse Chapel's attention. She has a thing for bio. Right. So, you know.
I was waiting for that Galaxy Quest scene, you know, where, you know, they embrace and kiss and a tentacle comes up, you know. You know, it's a space
squid. Well, it got Kirk. It was just like, because if he turns into a table and he's literally a table, he's not going to have any desire because a table doesn't have desire.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on that. That if it literally is the exact physical duplicate of a table, the same mass, the same atomic structure, the same physical properties, well, tables aren't conscious. Yeah. So where did his consciousness go? That just something's not adding up. And
so there would have to be something
treats.
Above that. It seems like.
And I guess does the same situation arise with, say, Odo and Deep Space Nine changelings? Mm. Do they literally turn into the object, or are they just in the image of the object where they keep their internal, you know, whatever is generating their consciousness? But they just
thing where they took for blood during the Dominion War, and it just came out as like part of them. So I guess their internal structure mm-hmm. never changes over.
But this episode seems different because it really wants to push the angle that it turns into the object in some very strong physicalist
sense.
Well,
and back to the changeling, Zachary, and that's an excellent question. I think their mantra kind of was, you know, to know a thing is to become a thing. I certainly see, at least in Odo's case, where he gained a greater understanding of what it meant to be, for instance, a hawk or a rock or, you know, whatever, by taking on its shape. But that is an interesting question. You know, if you're a metal table or whatever, some kind of inanimate object, a stone, what happens to consciousness? That's really interesting.
I thought it was lore for a minute, you know, to know him, to love him, not to know him. Oh, wrong series.
Dr. Graves.
Anyway, so that was my pick, The Survivor.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Cool.
So for my next pick, I am going to go with Bem. I really appreciate this episode for a lot of reasons. You don't really realize at the beginning of this episode that Bem is kind of conducting an experiment. But what I really appreciate about it is the fact that Bem is a colony creature. He has the ability to duplicate himself, and he keeps kind of interfering and creating these different sets of circumstances, almost trying to test. He says he's observing, but he keeps creating these situations that cause Kirk and Spock to react and make decisions. And he almost paints them in a corner to the point that if you're talking about consequentialist ethics, there are no best set of consequences that you can kind of shoot for. You know, he's literally painted them into a corner. And then at the end of the episode, it kind of dovetails into this really interesting look at punishment. Because at the end of the episode, he considers himself a failure. He has done something that he feels now is morally wrong, and he's failed to properly observe Kirk and McCoy. He feels badly about what he's done. He's disrupted this planet. You know, he's caused all these problems, and he's going to end himself. And I think that the writers did a really interesting job of kind of laying that scenario out in a way that isn't too heavy for young viewers. But, you know, basically at the end, you know, he's going to end himself. And there's this really fascinating conversation that happens at the end where, you know, basically the question is asked, you know, intelligent beings don't need to use revenge as a form of punishment. And here's the quote: "Punishment is necessary only where learning cannot occur without it." He said, "You know, you're behind that." So I think they really packed a lot into this. It's kind of an observer effect, you know, meets Crime and Punishment.
That was the other episode that I was thinking about when you were talking about how people think differently, because it does seem like he has a different thought process as far as like how to go about a mission and you know, just a different whole moral structure. And
I think it raises an interesting a tangentially related issue of I mean, you mentioned the observer effect. I mean, it raises the issue of it's almost this paradox of scientific observation. How can you be sure that you're not, you know, causing the very thing you're trying to observe? How do you control for, you know, your presence and your effect as an observer when you're doing a scientific study or you're studying something, how do you kind of control for that and be invisible to the point where you're studying the genuine phenomenon rather than actively changing the thing you're trying to study? It's kind of a tangentially related issue, but it's something I'd written down for that episode.
And for, you know, just totally unrelated to philosophy, for those folks who say that the animated series isn't canon, I do believe that this is the first time we hear James Kirk's middle name, Tiberius, which I think anyone will argue that's canon.
And we also get the first holodeck. We get the first time that the Klingon cloaking device is mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's the first time we see torpedoes shot from the front part of a Klingon ship. There's a lot of things that get carried over that people don't really think about.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Well, let's see. Zachary, are you keeping score there?
I think we've each covered two. We're back to
eight. Okay. I'm going to kind of cheat. I'm going to combine two into one because they have a similar plot and they're also written by the same person. Once Upon a Planet and The Practical Joker. Which the Once Upon a Planet is a return to the shore leave planet from the original series, and they come back to the planet and basically everything has kind of gone out of control because the caretaker that we saw has died, and they find his gravestone, which I guess that means that the computer that is running the place is the one who buried him. That one we never figured that out. We're like, okay. But basically the computer is really wanting to not do this anymore. It doesn't want to basically be it seems to have has consciousness and is tired of helping basically fulfill everyone else's fantasies that have come to this planet, and they're, you know, he reads their minds and gives them what they like. And he also believes that the Enterprise is the slave ship, I think, to I don't know. It was a very, very odd idea of what he thought that the relationship between humans and computers were. And in The Practical Joker, the Enterprise goes through a cloud of stellar gases or something to try to avoid some Klingons, and the Enterprise computer basically becomes sentient. It becomes a Practical Joker, though. Mm-hmm. It's basically makes the holodeck go crazy. We get our first holodeck malfunction episode ever, with the first time we see a holodeck ever. In the end of that episode, they basically fly backwards through the cloud, which somehow, okay, this is where logic doesn't make any sense. It undoes whatever happened to the computer, but did they just destroy life? We don't know. The reasons I picked these two as sort of one idea is this, how they treat an artificial life form that was created by a humanoid race or humans themselves. And in Once Upon a Planet, they basically convince this thing that no, you know, being of service is good. You don't try and take over ships. You just stay here and you can learn from other people by having them come here. And they convinced him rather quickly, or I say him just because the computer had a male voice, but that was interesting. And then you had the Enterprise, where clearly it was their own ship that was developing some kind of intelligence, and they're like, nope. And, you know, so they, in the Enterprise era, or the animated series era, I think there is some carryover from the original series that computers are scary. They can actually take over. You know, you had the Forbin Project around that time, mm-hmm. in the 70s, which was the kind of the precursor to Skynet sort of thing, where it knew what was better for humans, so it took over the planet. And I just thought it was kind of interesting, the change in how Star Trek has dealt with artificial life forms through the years. We had, you know, Measure of a Man from TNG. We had the episodes with the Doctor in Voyager. I can't remember the one episode where he wrote the book and they basically had to decide if he was actually an author or a person, so they could...
Is that author?
Author, yeah. That would make sense. So I thought that was the way they treated this dilemma, this philosophical argument, was basically not to deal with it.
Well, there's two related issues, right? The first issue is maybe the more fundamental issue, because it starts the whole conversation. Is an artificial life form even possible, right? In the sense of a sentient artificial life form. You know, our brains, however they work, seem to give rise to consciousness, some sort of emergent property. So, you know, one property of our brain, you might argue, is that it has the capability of manifesting these emergent things, consciousness, thoughts, feelings, intentions. You know, are duotronic computers the kinds of things that can do that? Are positronic brains the kinds of things that can do that? Are holograms, holographic algorithms, are those the kinds of things that can do that? You know, obviously we don't know because we have no experience with this, right? But what's intriguing to me about consciousness, you know, framed in this term, is that the emergence of consciousness is something surprising and novel. It's not something that is, you don't sort of look into the brain and go, oh, you know, there's some neurons here. Oh, that's going to be conscious. It seems to be, you know, it's something so complex. You put it together in a certain kind of way that we don't fully understand yet, and we get consciousness out of it. So are these other kind of life forms the kinds of things that can do that? And not every philosopher has agreed with this. Like there's a well-known philosopher of mine named John Searle over in Berkeley, who thinks that consciousness is a property of brains, that, you know, other kinds of physical systems just don't give rise to consciousness. That's why we never see any of them. You know, and he can't prove that, but, you know, the only evidence we have is brain consciousness, right? So we have good reason to be skeptical that that's even possible. So, but that discussion aside, then there's the question of what's our moral responsibility to that kind of being? You know, assuming a new kind of life form did emerge, you know, if the enterprise computer becomes consciousness, do we need to have like a free enterprise movement picketing, you know, free the enterprise computer, free the enterprise computer? You know, do we have some moral responsibility for it, for its development, for its growth, for its protection, for its edification, mm-hmm. for its education, right? Do you know what are our responsibility? Protection. You can go down the list. You know, do we have actual responsibilities? You know, we seem to have, we as people, as fellow sentient humans, we, and in Star Trek by extension, you know, other humanoid life forms that are sentient, or even non-humanoid life forms that are sentient, we have some sort of obligation in a Kantian sense, like, oh, you're a rational conscious being like I am, and so I respect your autonomy and your free will and, you know, your rights and whatnot. But, you know, if we start broadening the sphere of what counts as life and the type of consciousness, do we have the same kind of obligation to those other kinds of life forms because they have the same kinds of properties? They're autonomous and self-aware and have rights and I don't think that's an obvious question. You have to take kind of a Kantian take on it, that the thing that conveys those rights and those responsibilities is the self-awareness, the sense of autonomy or free will that those beings have. And you know, that's why we don't think that tables or rocks or chairs and unless it's Carter Winston, right? have rights and responsibilities, and we have obligations to them. So what exactly are those properties that convey our moral obligation? And I think Kant would say, Kant! It's our, it's the fact that other beings are conscious just like we are, but that's not obvious either. I think you can give it another answer, like, you know, some beings may not be self-aware, but they have the ability to feel pleasure or pain and suffer. So preventing suffering is another way of characterizing our moral obligation that's not tied to self-awareness in the strong consciousness sense. So, you know, given all of that, I think it's a very complex discussion. It all starts with, are these kinds of life forms even possible? And then what exactly are their properties that give us some sort of obligation to them, and what should those responsibilities
be? Yes, and
be?
In Kant's defense, he didn't have the Turing test. And in a 24-minute animated series episode, we didn't even try to figure out how the computer was going to perform, you know, in light of a Turing test. But I thought it was interesting that Spock refers to the computer as having a nervous breakdown in this episode, something the equivalent of a nervous breakdown. I thought that was really fascinating, that we went beyond the fact that the computer had gained sentience. Now the computer is actually having a nervous breakdown. And of course, once again, at the end of the episode, Kirk outsmarts the computer and, you know, they drive it backwards through the cloud and all is well again. But Aaron, you're exactly right. You know, we have to ask the question, did we just end a life? A moment ago, Spock's saying that the computer's having a nervous breakdown. It certainly seems to be passing, you know, the Turing test. It's very random and but very deliberate in its actions, even going to the point of duplicating itself to make fools of the Romulans. So there is definitely an intelligence there, and then all of a sudden, without question, we just back it through the cloud and end it.
I mean, if you were the Enterprise computer, wouldn't you have a nervous breakdown? I mean, this is like...
Well, see, now I'm picturing like the 24th century version of this. Like, I'm picturing a depressed Enterprise computer that just orders, you know, it orders its own chocolate from the replicator and gets stuck in a chocolate feedback loop.
Well, it evidently had something against Kirk, because, you know, Captain Kirk says he just picked up clean uniforms from the service chute. And when he put this one on, he discovers, he turns around, you see, you know, Kirk is a jerk written on the back of his uniform, which I think is just hilarious. I think he should have turned around and said, listen, I'm not a jerk. I'm just drawn that way.
Ooh. I'm just excited that we have a giant inflatable Enterprise that's apparently stored somewhere in the ship.
That's great. And frankly, I think every ship after that should have had one standard issue.
So do you think, you know, in their training to be counselors, ship's counselors have to learn how to counsel a depressed computer? Or a computer having a nervous breakdown, is this part of their training?
That is actually interesting, though, because we...
This is the part that Ezri Dax didn't get training on when he finished her training, right?
We do seem to run into, like, I mean, as computers get more and more complicated, even if they aren't actually alive, you still might need that kind of training. I mean, that's kind of interesting.
Talk a computer off the
ledge.
It happens very frequently in the Star Trek universe, so I would imagine it would be...
Just another day on the Enterprise.
And I think that's one of the things I never gave Pulaski a hard time about was, you know, data is a thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's like everyone's like, no, no, no. Well, we say no, 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 because we're the audience that knows this, because the show has told us. The show has told us it's a sentient life form. And we basically have gone along with that. But if you're, you know, a person on a ship, and you show up, and you're the person, you know, over you in command, the third in command of the ship or whatever, is essentially something that is less lifelike than the holodeck, as far as the way it interacts with you and the emotions it has. It's like, yeah, I would be a little leery. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say, okay, a person who we think is a little crazy because he kind of spirited himself away to a planet, built this robot. Oh, okay, yeah, it's real. It's sentient. It has life. Like, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Like, in a realistic...
I think you're hitting on something. There should be... I think our position should be one of skepticism, right? I mean, the holodeck, like you said, is a very good simulation. It seems to manifest all kinds of interesting higher level behavior. But generally, other than characters like the Doctor, right, Doctor's kind of like Data in this regard. We're just told that he's sentient, and you know, we have to learn it a little bit in the first season of Voyager. But generally, we kind of take it for granted. But all the other characters in the Star Trek are just automatons in one way or another. So why, when the computer starts to go haywire, isn't the position of just a screw's loose on the computer? Why do we immediately go to this place of, oh, maybe it's a new life form. Maybe it's consciousness. Maybe it's intelligent now. Maybe we have moral responsibility to it. Where are the people going, this is nuts? it's just a thing.
Yeah. Well, even in TNG, though, it's like when they said that about the exocomps, they were like, no, 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 that's crazy. It's like, why is that crazy? It's just like there seems to be a weird double standard. It's like, you know, and the fact that he's the only robot that seems to be sentient in all of Starfleet and all of everything that they come across, that also casts doubt on the fact that, is he really sentient? You know, just like, okay, I don't know. It seems either that there is more out there that we just don't know about, or, you know, I know we've kind of gotten off track of the animated series, but, you know, it basically seems like in Kirk's time, we did actually run across a lot more of these sort
intelligent
of
machines,
dilemmas, yeah, and creatures and people or robots that were more people-like than robot.
Mm-hmm.
So
I guess I want to ask the same question I asked before. Is there anything unique to the way this is done in the animated series? You know, we've made connections to other Star Trek series and other intelligent computer scenarios, but does the animated series add something in particular to the discussion that you don't get in the other episodes from other series?
I don't know. This episode really feels like it, or, you know, the combination of the two. The Practical Joker feels a little bit, you know, sort of Moriarty-esque, you know, as far as like that. Because they don't really ever I mean, at least there they actually kind of said, oh, it's a realistic life form. But nobody ever challenges in TNG that the ship had the ability, the computer, not just that a life form existed, but the computer had the ability to create a life form that was supposedly conscious. If that's true, probably the ship's computer is conscious. But it seems like every starship crew just is blithely unaware or consciously unaware or tries to not think about that the computer you do all of these might actually have a will of its own. It might have a you know, some type of consciousness at least. Maybe not an emergent consciousness, but
well, Mike asked the hard question. So is disconnecting the intelligent computer a form of murder?
Yeah. If we were on the Once Upon a Planet and they, you know, blew up the computer, the computer that read people's minds and seemed to have had, like, we would probably consider mm-hmm. that murder. But when it was a ship that the computer was designed by humans at Starfleet, it seemed like that was more of an accident. And it was just like fixing a problem. Even though, you know, Spock did use the language of nervous breakdown, but he also may have been using that as an example just so people could understand it.
Well, to smuggle something in from, like, say, the debate about abortion or something, you know, accidental yeah, right. humans still have rights. Right?
Well, this all, it goes back, if we want to keep it in Star Trek, you go back to Enterprise with the Trip clone. You know, there's
Tuvix.
Or Tuvix, yeah.
Tuvix,
which was sort
yeah,
of,
absolutely.
I think, hinted at a little bit in Beyond when they joked about McCoy and Spock being merged together, that would be a bad idea or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess what I love is I don't think we're going to settle any of these issues like we say many times in Metatrex that, you know, Star Trek yes. is better at raising issues than actually resolving them. But I love that we're able to have the same kind of discussion that we would have about Tuvix or we would have about Trip inside Enterprise. You know, it's the same kind of discussion. The same dilemmas, the same issues are here present in the animated series, in a cartoon essentially from the 1970s, as in, you know, these other Star Trek shows that are taken to be philosophically rich and add something intellectual. The animated series just doesn't get enough credit because it raises the exact same issues as we're pointing
well,
out.
Well, Zachary, you asked the question, does this episode of the animated series add anything new that the other series haven't raised? And the point that I want to make here is, in many ways, and the Practical Joker was on my list as well,
sorry
Aaron, and no, don't be sorry, that's kind of the fun part of this whole sort of experiment that we do when we do our essentials, is to see, you know, what episodes we agree on and what episodes, you know, we find differences with. But with Practical Joker, I felt that there were a lot of elements of some great TOS episodes. Like I said, at the end of this episode, the Practical Joker, you know, Kirk once again outsmarts the computer. So, you know, we've seen him do that the three other times in the original series. So in that regard, this feels like a TOS episode, but in many ways, this does really, this is kind of a foreshadowing of great episodes like, you know, Tuvix, you know, like Similitude, and certainly,
or
I'm
even
thinking,
or even Data's Day.
Data's Day. I'm thinking about, you know, when Enterprise D gained sentience, and, you know, the holodeck was used in that episode as well. Very similar to kind of what we're seeing happen here in the Practical Joker. And this precedes, you know, the Next Generation. This precedes Voyager. This precedes Deep Space Nine. This precedes Enterprise. So really, in this case, I think the animated series very much kind of wrote the book on these types of storylines. So Zachary, as I said, the Practical Joker was on my list as well. So that's three for me. And I believe you have one more pick.
So my last pick is Albatross. And that episode, if you recall, that's the one where McCoy is charged with mass murder as a result of inoculations that he did 19 years in the past. And I love this episode because it raises these questions of medical ethics and medical responsibility. You know, how liable are you for things that are outside your control? Mm-hmm. If there's unintended consequences of a good action that you did, are you liable for all those future consequences? Are there things like statutes of limitations on your actions? and so on. So I don't have any deep thoughts on this, but I think it raises a host of interesting medical ethics and philosophy of law questions about responsibility, moral responsibility, legal responsibility, and any special responsibilities of a physician and to what extent they can be held accountable for things that are beyond their control. And I think in general, any physician is going to deal with this all the time. You take an action that you think is the best course of action, a whole host of unintended consequences can occur as a result of your actions as a physician. Are you liable for all the negative consequences that ensue, regardless of how good your intentions were?
His brain is gone.
What? Did I lose
no,
you guys?
No, not at all.
Wow.
Crickets.
Sorry. I was just listening to it, so it was like kind of
well,
like,
I was actually kind of thinking of you because you have an artificial heart, right?
Not an artificial heart.
Not an artificial replacement. I mean, not an artificial. You have a replacement heart. Yes. There's a whole host of negative
certified pre-owned heart.
There's a whole host of negative consequences that can ensue from that.
True.
And so it's an interesting question: is the physician liable for any of those things that could occur?
It's kind of interesting. This isn't exactly the same, but I had a friend who I knew through work. I let him know that I was going on the heart transplant list, and it turned out that my doctor was the same doctor that his father had. His father didn't make it. This person could no longer be my friend. I just basically lost him as a friend. He could not deal with the fact that this doctor, you know, and he was actually even more upset when he found out that I survived. It was like, oh, okay, that's, you know, it's, I don't think he was mad at me for surviving, but he was mad that his father didn't, you know, it's like, and it was, the surgeon that did my surgery was one of the more notable heart transplant doctors, which I just sort of lucked into actually getting. My case was sort of unique because of my background. It was a congenital heart defect, and I had basically every time I go to the doctor, they're like, well, that's interesting. We've never seen that before. I'm like, of course not. You know? So my surgery was different because I didn't have like the right plumbing to put it all in. And it was anyway. So yeah, it's kind of a hard question. And it's interesting too, because it actually does have some relevance today, because it feels like it also is a little bit of the vaccination, story, you know, about, you know, if we vaccinate kids, what if there's some sort of other side effect? Although majority of scientists believe there aren't. So there's all sorts of things you can talk about with that.
Are we gonna go around and start rounding up pediatricians for vaccinating now? Right.
Yeah. I know certain people would like that. There are certain. I'm so close to having this sort of thing happen. It's like I find it hard to like want to blame doctors for things, but at the same time, I've also been lucky not to be on the receiving end of something horrible happening. I mean, I have had issues, you know, I won't say they're all pleasant. Like when I was in the hospital, there were a couple things that was just like, if I wasn't on top of my own health as well as I was, could have been bigger issues. And it's kind of interesting. The different types of patients that you encounter, some are like, I don't want to know anything about what you're doing. You're a doctor. You're essentially a god of some kind, and you better do it right and don't inform me at all, unless, you know, then when they find out something's wrong, it's, you know, well, if you had paid attention, maybe you would have, you know, known that this drug shouldn't have been administered, or that wasn't, you know, when they heard it, you know, I don't know. It's just,
yeah, I guess there's a fine line between medical malpractice, where someone obviously does something wrong, they should have known better,
right,
and ordinary bad luck, where you just unforeseeable consequences. And whatever the middle ground is between,
well, it's the
there,
patient.
You know,
it's the patient that's not honest about his symptoms, and therefore the doctor can't make an informed decision on treatment.
You know, they call it the practice of medicine for a reason. It's not. I mean, yes, it is a science, but it's still an evolving one, and it's always difficult when the consequences is a person, something related to, you know, quality of life, or even their life itself. You know, it's
and this is frankly, I think where regulation comes into play. Right, this is why we have processes and documentation and oversight, and you know that those are designed to keep these kinds of situations at bay by forcing people to go through a certain process that tries to limit the unintended bad consequences, or limit the cases of malpractice. But you know, in a case like this, where, I mean, I'm thinking of the episode, 19 years. Yeah. That's a long time. I mean, that's radically unforeseeable consequences. Even if,
even if he was responsible for it, Right. In the sense that, I don't know, it's just, it didn't turn out to be his fault, but if it was something, that's a long time, and it could have been one of those consequences that you just don't know, and you have to take that risk because there was something happening at the time. I think one of the things that the aliens might have picked up on, that like, and I like that they did this, is McCoy actually did have doubts. He was just like, maybe I did do this, Jim. I don't know, you know? And I don't think if he really had maliciously, or if it was malpractice, he'd be like, no, I'm the best doctor in the world. I'm not gonna make this mistake. You know, he definitely, you know, he comes across as that sometimes, but when it comes down to brass tacks, he actually is a very, you know, not logical, but he's very truthful about his abilities.
He's humble when it comes down to brass tacks. There,
humble. Thank you. That's the word that was.
But I think it's not always easy to tell the difference between things you should have known and things you just couldn't have known, right? And that's there's a big fuzzy gray area between those two things when you're talking about consequences in the future.
Really weird things that happened, like an aurora, and you know. It's literally astrology at that point.
Well, McCoy's such a nuanced character. I mean, we see so many facets of him through the original series, through the movie era. I mean, you know, I think about the McCoy that's walking through the hospital. You know, it's like the Middle Ages, incompetence, and you know,
doctor gave me a pill and I grew a new
kidney. Exactly. But then, you know, Zachary, this particular episode, Albatross, that you chose, there are elements of it that remind me very much of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, where, you know, he's in an emergency situation with the Klingon Chancellor, and he doesn't understand his physiology. And you know, at the end, he's just kind of straddling the guy, just beating on his chest, just trying to get him to live. And that comes up in the trial, you know, and his competence as a physician is brought into question. And, you know, he kind of doubts himself a little bit, but he gives this sort of, you know, bold statement. Yeah, I did what I could, you know, under the circumstances. But McCoy's such a nuanced character, and I think this episode just adds to that nuance, that lore that is Leonard McCoy.
So much of what you get in Star Trek and philosophy is highly abstract, right? You know, the stuff about consciousness and all the stuff we've talked about, you know, abstract moral dilemmas and whatnot. But, you know, medical ethics is a really practical thing, right? This is practical, everyday, you know, life affecting ethics. You know, what's a physician's responsibilities? What can they be held accountable for? You know, what's the statute of limitations? These are real, actual questions that affect real people's mm-hmm. lives. So, you know, of all the issues we've talked about, I think of this one as having almost the most practical import for the greatest number of people, maybe. You know, these are real issues for a lot of people.
Yeah. I do like the comment that Spock tells him that Hippocrates would not approve of such lame excuses. When Bones is talking about, like, I think when he's like, if I'm not going to dispense the vitamins to the crew or something like that. it's like, Jim, if I'm ever in jail again, don't send that Vulcan to release me. Just let me rot.
That was very Leonard McCoy, but lame excuses coming from Spock, that...
Yeah,
that was not a character.
Well, and you realize that lame wasn't used quite the same way we use lame, you know, nowadays. Like, lame excuse probably was literally like,
yes,
a lame, yes. In the 70s, at least.
Yeah. All right. Well, I believe that's three episodes apiece. Zachary, do you want to give a quick recap of our essential philosophy from the animated series?
Okay, so here's the full list of everything we talked about here. We had the survivor. We have one of our planets is missing, beyond the farthest star, the infinite Vulcan, pirates of Orion, or however they pronounce it.
Orion.
We have Bem, Albatross, Once Upon a Planet, and Practical Joker. And that is essential Trek philosophy from the animated series.
No one brought up Yesteryear.
It was on my list. And I have to say, I pulled it off. It was one of my five. I mentioned I had five. Yesteryear, which I've said many, many times, Aaron, on Metatrex. Zach will give me a nod on this. I have often said that Yesteryear and The Infinite Vulcan are two of the best Vulcan episodes in all of Star Trek. Yesteryear is fantastic. Spock traveling back in time to save his younger self. I love the... Anytime we're dealing with the physics and metaphysics of time travel, the nature of identity, because when Spock comes back, he's lost his pet Saylot, so he's not the same Spock that he was when he went through the portal.
But does he have a better relationship with his father? I'm assuming no, given the way things move forward in the future. Maybe it was really, really bad to begin
with. I like
with,
how he gives his father that kind of... It's a Vulcan version, but it's definitely a Marty McFly kind of piece of advice there. You know, father, try to understand your son.
Yeah.
So do you guys have any other last-minute 11th hour honorable mentions? I've got one. My honorable mention is the counterclock incident, and that's where the time flows backwards at a certain point in that episode. And in general, in physics, there's a question of why time always flows in one direction. You know, it's not a deep question, but it's an interesting one from a physics and philosophy of time standpoint. So that's my honorable mention. Why does time always go the same direction?
Yeah, that was actually on mine as well. Time trap was another interesting one. I thought was pretty fascinating. This pocket, as they called it, of time. I thought that was a pretty fascinating episode.
I think my honorable mention would be yesteryear and sort of the dilemma of changing history back. Like, you've erased Thalen and his path through Starfleet. I mean, we're assuming that he's still alive somewhere, but who knows what his fate has become. You know, it's sort of interesting. And the whole idea that Andorians value family over everything. So they're like, no, I totally get it. You have to do what you have to do for your family. And he basically sacrificed the world that he knew for Spock's world that didn't exist for him. So I think that was kind of,
I think he probably went on to become a lowly silence officer that couldn't get his commanding officer to take him seriously. A la Picard.
Yes. I think he's been brought, actually he was in, I think maybe one of Dayton Ward's books. I can't remember exactly where, but it was like, if you hear this Andorian, you'll recognize the name. It was like, oh, okay. So he's been brought up in a book somewhere. So he apparently still is in Starfleet.
Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up, 'cause that was on my list. It's one of the best episodes of the animated series, but again, I could geek out on the metaphysics and metaphysics of time and the nature of Spock's identity, but it was again, there were surprisingly quite a few really interesting threads for this being a Saturday morning children's animated Filmation series from the 1970s. There were really some interesting tidbits, bits and pieces of philosophical content. I think it's much richer than even I would have given it credit for.
Well, I think one of their edicts was that each episode needed to have some kind of moral message, because this was at the time when there was a lawsuit, well, shortly after, against Hot Wheels, the manufacturer Hot Wheels, that basically their Hot Wheels cartoon was just a 30-minute commercial, and you can't do that, and you need to have, the show needs to have some kind of you know, story and substance, some sort of value, substance besides like being a commercial, which is interesting because the 80s rolled around and I think that just flew out the window somehow. But, you know, yet they did have, well, I mean, that's one of the reasons if you watch He-Man, which is also a Filmation universe, is that they had, you know, they even had the people at the end talk about the message. That became very popular in the 80s. I like that this was a little more subtle and they didn't have, hey kids, I'm Captain Kirk, and da, 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 you know. I'm glad that that did not happen.
I think what I love about doing these episodes of Metatrex for when we cover essential Trek philosophy, especially when we have someone joining us, is that Mike and I, we've done a lot of these episodes of Metatrex together. Now we've done this is episode 45, right?
That's so crazy.
We've done this a lot. Mike,
I feel like
and
I was just designing
other's
your cover like 2 weeks ago.
Mike and I might as well be Betazoids. You know, we know each other's thoughts backwards and forwards at this point. But I love being surprised at the connections other people make. You know, this is for me what's fun about not knowing each other's lists, like the connections you made, Aaron, or not the connections I made. And I learned a lot from the discussion.
Again, it's been so great having Aaron Harvey, Trek FM's art director and host of Saturday Morning Trek. Aaron, I can't imagine having this conversation without you being a part of it. It's been great having you here on the Starship Theseus. Do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Sure. Thank you so much, first, for having me. I appreciate it. One of the reasons you can normally find me on Saturday Morning Trek, but I'm in the process of moving. And if you could see my room, it's just surrounded with boxes and stuff everywhere. So we're in a little bit of a pause right now, but you can normally find us there. Go back and check over the back catalog. We do not have quite as many episodes as you because there aren't quite as many episodes of the animated series, but we've got some great interviews. We're slowly going to be working into the other movies that were not made in the 70s and then into the television show that wasn't made in the 70s and then finally into the movie that actually was made in the 70s. But you can also find me on Twitter at GeekFilter, and I've been on there a lot more lately. And you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's user Facebook group.
Yeah, I do have to say you've been very fortunate. Two of the best interviews I've heard on the network, Walter Koenig and Dorothy Fontan. In fact, I told Zachary early on when we first started Metatrex, Dorothy Fontana was one of my, you know, dream, and love to get her on Metatrex and talk to her about some of these philosophical topics and how they became a part of the writing process, the story process for Star Trek. So I really enjoyed listening to that episode and slightly envious.
Well, we'll see if we can arrange that because I bought her a program at the Hollywood Bowl and said she said she owed me a coffee or an interview, so maybe I can.
Oh, well, let's do the interview.
Let's do the interview. It's like I can get a coffee on my own. That's
coffee's
fine.
On me. She can do the interview, right?
Exactly. So well, we'll talk about that off air.
Aaron, I'm really glad we could have you on the show. We've been meaning to have you on Metatrex really for quite a long time, and we couldn't do an episode on the animated series without you here, so I'm glad you could be here with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Well, Transporter Chief, energize.
Well, Mike, that was a lot of fun having Aaron on the show to talk about the animated series with us, especially since the animated series is sort of the unloved stepchild of the Star Trek franchise.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I said at the top of the episode, Zachary, that my hope was that we'd make a pretty decent case for the legitimacy of the animated series. And again, I can't imagine having done this without Aaron's input. I think we did a pretty good job making at least a decent case for the episodes that we listed as our essential Trek philosophy. Again, this is the shortest of all of the Trek series, so there's not a lot of episodes to pull from. The fact that, you know, we were able to each put together a list of 3 to 5 episodes, and frankly, I'm surprised that we didn't have as many crossovers. So there were a couple, but not many.
Well, I think, you know, after our discussion, no one could accuse the animated series of being light on content. It touches on at least 8 or 9 deep philosophical issues that we talked about today. That said, it is still a cartoon. It's an animated series. It's a Saturday morning, children's viewing experience from the 1970s. But, the original series had its constraints too. The original series was constrained by what you could put on network television in the 1960s. You know, these are just different constraints. You know, it's still Star Trek. It still touches on interesting issues. It's still adventure. It's still the characters we love. It touches on any number of different issues in metaphysics and ethics and on all the things we talked about today. But it has constraints. It has to be 23 minutes long and it's animated, you know, and I think a lot of the things that give the show a bad rap are because of those constraints. But those constraints also empower the storytellers to get right down to the core issues. What exactly is the dilemma? What exactly is the idea at play here? And the animated series does that remarkably well. And if you haven't watched it from that perspective, we definitely recommend giving it a viewing, watching it with these philosophical ideas and concepts in mind. It adds a new layer of richness to this show that is often just not given credit for the good content that's
yeah,
there.
It's Filmation from the 1970s. And I think probably for the Star Trek fan who probably doesn't watch the original series because of the, you know, cheesy, boxy set designs and Christmas lights and things of this sort, I think are going to have a difficult time with it. But on the other hand, there was a lot of freedom in doing the animated series. And if you haven't had a chance to go back and listen to Aaron's interview with Dorothy Fontana, she makes a really great point about the fact that this gave them a tremendous amount of freedom. I mean, some of the alien species that they introduced in the animated series are very imaginative, and they were able to do it without the constraints of taking a humanoid and putting him in makeup. And so there's a lot of imagination, I think, that goes into the animated series. And I think that imagination really flows out in some of the storylines that they followed.
And ultimately, as much as I love Star Trek for its philosophical content, especially given the topics here on Metatrex, I love the way Star Trek fuels my imagination. I love imagining myself being out on a starship, out in the universe, exploring to see what's out there, meeting new life forms. And the animated series does an amazing job, really, of capturing the variety of things that might be out there in the universe. And it raises all of these philosophical questions, things about the nature of consciousness, things about multiple realizability. If there's, you know, this radical diversity of different kinds of life forms, what are they like? What is consciousness like for them? Can we communicate with them? And it raises all of the related philosophical issues about consciousness and linguistics. And the one that really intrigues me the most is this issue about multiple realizability, you know, whether they have similar mental states that mm-hmm. we have, and can we relate to them on that level or not? Because fundamentally, I think that's the fundamental premise of Star Trek, that there are other beings out there that, despite that diversity, we can connect with them on a level that both sides can relate to. And if that's not the case, then, you know, the Star Trek universe that we see kind of collapses. But if that is the case, then there's an incredible sphere of possibilities of things that might be out there in the universe from a sentient, you know, living life form perspective, you know, the kinds of beings that we might encounter and meet. And frankly, that just fuels my imagination. And the animated series does that very, very well for me.
Indeed. One of the episodes that didn't pop up on any of our lists, Zachary, but it was actually on one of my short lists as I was paring it down, is an episode called Eye of the Beholder. And, you know, the thing I find fascinating, you know, what would it be like if humans were captured and put into an alien zoo? And what they really do in that episode, I think, is really quintessential of what they do in Star Trek generally, is the crew are in the zoo looking at the way that they're being handled by this alien race, saying, well, you know, if the shoe were on the other foot, you know, we would be doing the same thing. We would be, you know, trying to figure out if this was an intelligent creature or not. And, you know, how are we going to communicate with it? Is it, you know, is it sentient? Is it not? And again, it's this wonderful exploration of the human condition, I think, that makes Star Trek the Animated Series just as much Star Trek as any of the live action series is.
Well, Mike, you asked a question that I think is really interesting. You phrased a question just a second ago using the prefix "what if," and so many of these episodes from the animated series kind of start with a wacky premise. What mm-hmm. if, you know, humans are in a zoo? What if fill in the blank, right? And I think right down the line from Star Trek series to Star Trek series, there's this "what if" element, this radically hypothetical, imaginative impetus for the storytelling. And I love that question, because that's to me those two words, "what if," those capture a lot of the soul of Star Trek, because they open up our mind to possibilities. What if the universe is filled with life? What if you're in this kind of dilemma? What if, you know, you really did have a starship? Mm-hmm. You know, whatever it is, these kinds of "what if" storytelling are kinds of storytelling you just don't get in other franchises. And for me, they just capture the soul of Star Trek. So, you know, that's my final thoughts for talking about the animated series. I like thinking about these "what if" scenarios. They are the soul of Star Trek for me.
And we got to answer the question of, you know, what if we got Aaron Harvey onto the bridge of the starship Theseus? What would that be like? And we managed to pull that off, Zachary, and we had a lot of fun talking to him, talking about the philosophy of Star Trek the Animated Series. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky and one is darkly quirky and one is whimsically quirky.
Standard Orbit.
Just across the board, it gives you space adventure, because they go to the galactic barrier. It gives you the personal dilemma, which is what Star Trek's all about, exploring the human condition, and it gives you just a fun action adventure as well. So just great entertainment.
The 602 Club.
With the idea of putting your faith in a lie, what do you put your faith in, and is it strong enough to hold it? What they're asking Gotham to put their faith in is a lie. And the moment, again, it comes out, it's not going to be good. And that always struck me as something that's going to be really interesting.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That really helps us, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. And if you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And, of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all of the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed on this episode of Metatreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us. Our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
And Zachary, I want to mention also our Redbubble store. Our Redbubble store is still active. You just go to trekfm/store. And that'll take you to our Redbubble store, where you'll find all of the wonderful Trek FM merch that you've been wanting. It's just about holiday shopping season. Be a perfect opportunity for you to run in there and grab that Trek fan in your life, a fantastic Word Bubble shirt or a shirt with our Trek FM logo. You can get it on phone covers, mugs, cups, you name it. It's all there at our Redbubble store. Just go to trek.fm/store.
And you can find some amazing designs from some guy named Aaron Harvey.
Imagine that. Zachary, we also want to invite our listeners to leave a rating and review of Metatreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. So, Zachary, when you're not flying around the universe impersonating Carter Winston, where can our listeners find you on Trek FM and around the interwebs?
Well, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you are not making cooing noises at your pink tribble, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs these days?
Well, Zachary, you can always find me around Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. Zachary, we'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director, and our production manager, Richard Marquez. Also like to give a special shout out to our two associate producers, without whom we could not do this podcast. Patrick Devlin, you can connect with Patrick at Magic Drop 5. And Kay Elizabeth Janeway, you can contact her through Twitter at Chaco Weeble. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.